Hi, this is Jeff Dales, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Hi, this is Steve Howe, and you're listening to me on the Yes Music Podcast. Have a good time. Listen. Bye.
Hi, this is Alan White from Yes, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
It was 40 years ago this week that a certain Yes album called Drama was released. And over the years on the Yes Music Podcast, we've spoken to some amazing Yes men, John Anderson, Steve Howe, Jeff Downes, Alan White, all sorts of people, even people like Fernando Perdomo and Oliver Wakeman and so on. But today is the big one. We are welcoming back that man from Northern Ireland, Jeff Bailey. Hello, Jeff.
Hello. Hello. What a build-up, my word.
I know, that's good, isn't it?
Second only to Fernando.
Some other people. And Mark is here as well. Hello, Mark.
Hello, everybody.
Great to be back. So we're going to have a little bit of a round table. It's quite a small round table, but there's three of us who can get round it and talk a little bit about Drama. So we've all come up with some statements or questions about Drama that we can kick around a bit this afternoon. But just to set the stage somewhat, as it were, for Drama, I've got one of John Kirkman's volumes of dialogue, the Yes interviews, and this is the first one of those. And there's an interview in there that he did with Jeff Downes about Drama back in 2002. So here's what Jeff Downes said at that distance from the album itself. He said, it was really strange when I think about it in hindsight, because Yes had always been this revered progressive rock band, and we were seen as coming in there as a couple of imposters, if you like. They saw us as a couple of pop guys coming in and joining our band. So we got quite a lot of resentment from the diehard Yes fans. They thought we had somehow desecrated the Yes legacy. From our own standpoint, it didn't really seem that weird. There was a lot of press about it, and they called us the Yeggles and things like that. It was very tongue-in-cheek. But as far as the album was concerned, when people took it at face value, it was a good album. I think that whether you're a Yes purist or not, the fact is the previous album, Tomato, had not been a popular album with Yes fans. The Drama album stood up as being a step in the right direction for Yes at that point. It wasn't as hard for me as it was for Trevor. Trevor had the unenviable task of taking over from Yes's only lead singer, whereas Yes had had three previous keyboard players, so it wasn't so bad for me. Right. Okay, so there's Jeff Downes. And I'm going to kick off with my statement. So, the Yes catalogue, the Yes legacy, would have been unaffected if the Buggles hadn't joined and Drama had never existed, and the band had just gone straight to 90125. So, starting off with Jeff, what do you think?
Would have been unaffected. Well, I suppose my first thought on that is we sort of can't really rewrite the history. And I think that the thing that, when you look at certainly the history of the band, there are very, very clear stepping stones. So I suppose, you know, the question relating to that is, well, 90125, its success was certainly very heavily influenced by Trevor Horn's contribution, and actually influenced by the fact that Trevor Horn decided to step back or step out of the vocalist role, but was still happy to be involved as a producer. Would he still have been in the mix had Drama not happened? And I mean, if you've heard any of the sort of the demos or the earlier versions of the 90125 tracks, I think it's probably fairly safe to say that they may not have been the massive commercial success that they were, and ultimately the kind of the adrenaline shot that Yes needed had it not had the Trevor Horn touch. So I think it would be very hard to conclude that it would have been unaffected if they had just jumped from one to the other.
Yeah. Mark?
Well, very good points, Jeff. They're very well said, but I'm going to disagree, because what I think, though, is that if they didn't make Drama, I don't think there wouldn't have been too big a problem. I mean, Drama, as much as I love Drama, and it's a great album, it's in my top five. But, you know, when you look at the songs in there, there are some great songs, some ones that are even considered classic, Tempest Fugit, you know, Machine Messiah. But I don't think those songs are held in the same regard as songs like, you know, Heart of the Sunrise, you know, Starship Trooper and songs like that. You know, so if that album didn't exist, I don't think there would have been too much missing from the catalog in that sense. And I think also because the Buggles had such a huge album at that time, and Trevor Horn was already being regarded as this great record producer, and knowing how Brian Lane is always chasing the dollar, as they said, I think that he would have got him involved anyways with them, regardless of his involvement as being in Yes or not. So I kind of think that Drava wouldn't have made that big an impact on their future, you know, moving forward success.
That's, again, very good points. Jeff, the Trevor Rabin aspect of 90125, surely that's more important than the Trevor Horn aspect?
I think it's very hard to separate the two of them, and I'm sure probably most people have seen the video, I think it's Red Bull interview, which is about a two-hour thing, where they're interviewing Trevor Horn about his entire career, and he talks at that stage about, for example, the version of Owner of a Lonely Heart before he got involved. Yeah. And, you know, the sort of this probably slightly cliched love type lyrics, I think he refers to. And, you know, I think to say that Trevor Horn just kind of operated a mixing desk, you know, very much understates his influence. I think it needed them both, but I think both needed the other. And I think the other thing I would say probably, I mean, I don't entirely disagree with what Mark has said, but Trevor Horn wasn't really a renowned producer at the point that he was in Yes. It was actually something that, at least from my reading, it was something that he decided to go wholeheartedly into because of the experience he had on stage with Yes that made him decide, I don't want to be a singer, I want to get into this. And I think his kind of kudos and reputation was built between probably the end of his period in Yes and that had been building in those few years in between, while the other guys were off doing Asia and stuff. To put him into the position where he was the right guy for 90125.
Yeah, yeah. It's fascinating, isn't it? I was listening to Drama today, in preparation for this, and what you say about his vocals. And interesting that he really wanted to put that version of the band back together for Fly From Here return trip, and to erase poor old Benoit David and put his vocals on it as if it were a drama too. But we are talking about Drama. So yes, I was listening very intently to his vocals, and do you know, I love his vocals on this, and I think they've got a huge amount of character, and he was taking over from John Anderson, it was very difficult and all that. But some of the top notes, particularly, even on the studio record, Mark, are not what you would maybe expect from a top-flight vocalist.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem was that, you know, being that he was in Yes, there was a certain expectation, I think, vocally from people that were going to step into that position. So I think if they would have told him and said, listen, you can sing however you want on this record, we wouldn't have gotten that vocal performance, I don't think. I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that they expected a certain kind of approach to it. You know, they didn't obviously expect him to sound exactly like John, because nobody can, right? But I think they kind of had a formula that they thought worked with their music. And I kind of have a feeling that that had a lot to do with the way he sang it too, right? Because, I mean, I'm guessing some of these songs were written, obviously, before he came into the band and had John Anderson in mind. So, obviously, that kind of vocal approach was already in mind when the songs were being written in the studio or recorded in the studio. So, I think that had a lot to do with it.
So, Jeff, last point on this then. So, his vocals, I mean, what about Trevor? Trevor Horn was in the right place at the right time. He just happened to be in the vicinity, literally, of the band. So had he not been in there at the right place at the right time, they would have gone with a arguably better lead vocalist.
I'm trying to keep my powder dry on some of the statements that I have made. So I'm gonna answer your question by not answering it, or okay. maybe even answering it by answering it with a question.
All right.
Do you think that drama sung by a John Anderson clone would have been as effective and as good an album? You know, I think that probably it's trying to answer that question in terms of if they'd gone for someone different, would it have been the same?
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to imagine John saying that. And yet, if you have the Rhino reissue
of
this
here.
Album,
yep.
there is an early version from the Anderson era of what became part of Run Through the Light called Dance Through the Light.
Yeah.
And if you actually listen to John Anderson singing in that, he doesn't sound unlike Trevor Horn. And he's singing in that kind of style because that's kind of what the slightly staccato style of the song, you know, needs.
Well, I mean, my response to that, because I mean, that's your first statement, so I'll have a go in then.
Mark. That wasn't my first statement. That was a supplementary one.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, whatever. It's a very interesting point. I think I would answer the question by saying, without Trevor Horn, I don't think you would have had Jeff Downes. And without the two of them, I think Jeff Downes, I read a quote from him recently saying that they came as a pair. You know, you couldn't have had one without the other. And it just so happened, fortuitously, as it turns out for us Yes fans, I think, that they happened to be in the right place at the right time. And the fact that there were two of them, and one was a keyboardist and one was a vocalist, or at least could turn his hand or voice to the vocals. And I think the album would be very different if Jeff Downes hadn't been there, and the two of them with their songwriting abilities and arranging abilities and their ear for creating something which maybe wasn't quintessential Yes in some ways, and I'm sure we'll come back to that a bit later, but certainly was an extremely successful synthesis of what they did and what Yes did at the time. What do you think, Mark?
I wanted to put in one point about this, though, because you were saying that if you had a John Anderson clone come in and do it, would it have been a better record? I want to say something a bit different about that. Why necessarily would there have to be a John Anderson clone for it to be better? What if they just had a better singer overall? That maybe that didn't sound like John Anderson. You know what I mean? Like, what if they had, you know, I don't know, James LaBrie? Or what if they had somebody who sounded like, you know, like another guy who was a really great kind of singer come in? Maybe it would have been better if they had like a totally different vocal approach. Like, even like, let's say, like, just hypothetically, like Freddie Mercury or somebody sang it. Would it have been a better record? Because it's a totally different vocal approach, but he's a great singer. Why does it have to sound like John Anderson for it to be a good record?
I think if you think about the characters that were there, Steve Howe, and Steve Howe has said in his autobiography, why on earth did they not have Roger Dean artwork on the previous two albums? And it was down to one particular member of the band. It doesn't name him, but I'm sure we could all guess which person it was who didn't want that. Mm-hmm. And certainly, you know, with the three of them who were left, I get the feeling that they were very close musically and personally at that time, and wanted to see Yes doing something. And they wanted it to feel like Yes, which is why we got one of the best, in my opinion, Roger Dean covers of all time, and certainly up to that time, I think it was one of the best. So I think that there was probably a desire amongst the three of them for it to be Yes, and that included perhaps some John Anderson vocal stylings. What do you think, Jeff?
Maybe. I think from, and sort of links into maybe what might be my first statement, but if you listen to everything that has kind of come out that is related to drama, if you listen to the stuff that Squire, High and White were coming up with, it's really great music, but it doesn't sound like they're trying to make a Yes album. Mm. You know, it sounds like three people who have come up with some good guitar riffs, great strong rhythm section, and are working with that, right? So, you know, those kind of tracks. And I suppose, so to lead it into kind of my statement, I actually, you know, I think Yes needed two things at this point in time, the common thing is, well, they didn't have a keyboard player and a vocalist, and that's what they needed. Mm. But actually, I think also, and perhaps equally as importantly, they needed material. Because if you read any of the history that says that the first encounter was that Brian Lehan brought Horn and Downs to the band to give them a song, to give them Fly From Here. And the step from that was, well, actually, because if you look at the album, I did a bit of research last night, and this is kind of going from what I can find on the internet. So, you know, it's true. But looking down the track list, Machine Messiah appears to have been written when they all got together.
Yeah. Yes.
White Car was done in a day. Does It Really Happen is, I think, came from one of the instrumentals that How White and Squire were working on. Mm-hmm. Into the Lens is a pure Buggles song that Yesified. Mm-hmm. Run Through the Light is a sort of a Paris leftover. And Tempest Fugit came from the How, Squire, and White jams.
Yeah.
So they really only had two things that ended up in the album. And with that said, putting all that together came up with an album that lasts for 36 minutes.
Yes. Yes.
So you know, I wonder, was the motivation here, we've got some jamming, but we don't have songs. Mm-hmm. And these popular songwriters were brought in who sort of got blended into the band. I don't know. What do you think of that?
I think it's a very reasonable idea, and you know, I think you're right. I think there was a desire to have some new material in there, and I was thinking about this in the context of what happened in Paris with Roy Thomas Baker and all the shenanigans there, and the thing completely splitting apart and disintegrating. And I think that was a lot to do with the direction of the two camps at the time. The three against the two, and the two being Wakeman and Anderson, who wanted to take it in a different direction and, you know, make it even, from whatever your point of view is, even worse than Tomato, or even better than Tomato, depending on how you think about these things. So I can certainly see that. What about you, Mark?
I think it answers a very interesting question. So if that's true, what Jeff just said, and I have no reason to think that it isn't, because I know Jeff is a very thorough researcher, then essentially John Anderson is the key writer for Yes, songwriting-wise. And really, Steve Howe and Chris Squire, you know, they just added things here and there by the sounds of it. Because if you look at it from that perspective, John Anderson was the one bringing in the songs. Mm. And they just kind of added their spices to it and made it into a Yes song. So it almost makes it sound like when John Anderson wasn't there, they were kind of looking at each other going, now what? Mm. You know, we've lost. It's kind of like Pink Floyd almost. When they lost Syd Barrett, they looked at each other and said, now what? And they started making records that were nothing but full-out jams for a while, until they started figuring out what to do and realizing that David Gilmour was a great singer, you know, and could start nursing that into something a little bit more than what it was before. So it's almost like John Anderson was the key to the whole thing back then, and then they had to figure out a way to do it so that they didn't have to rely anymore on just one individual.
And interestingly, if you think about 90125 emerging from cinema, it was Trevor's material, essentially. So perhaps he was taking the John Anderson role, as you've described it there. Jeff?
I was reading last night, and it's a shame I don't have it in front of me, but Prog Magazine, my subscriber copy landed yesterday, and there's an interview with John Anderson in it. Yep. And he talks actually a little bit about this. He says, I don't have it in front of me, so I'm sort of paraphrasing, but he says, I wasn't really the writer. I was the person who sort of helped them put it all together. And he talks about writing Close to the Edge and saying, you know, so the band were playing this thing, and I said to them, right, what I want this song to do is to start as if it's going at full speed, rather than building up and going. I wanted to start at full speed.
Yeah.
And so they sped it up, they played it, and then he says, right now, and then I wanted to stop suddenly, so it stops here, and then I'll go ba ba ba. And you know, so I think if that's I don't know whether that's writing or that's arranging.
Yeah.
But
it's arranging.
But you can see how that was maybe an element that they were missing, and that maybe that's what these guys brought as well as some of the songs.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make me the second person to have sung on the podcast after?
Probably does, actually. Yeah.
Excellent.
That's good. Okay, well, yeah, so the composition is an interesting one, but let's go on to Mark then. Take us in a different direction, Mark.
Oh boy, okay. So I'm going to go on to my second question. I'm going to skip my first one because I think this one might cause a little bit of a, not controversy, but I'm curious for your reaction to this. Okay. So the tour in 1980 was pretty successful in the US. They had sold out dates, you know, Madison Square Garden, this and that. It went pretty well, but not so much in the UK. As Steve Howe mentioned, that when they got over there in that documentary, he kind of, you know, looked down on the floor and saying, when we got to UK, we got totally hammered by the Yes fans with, you know, Trevor Horn in the band and stuff like that. So what does that say about North American Yes fans compared to the UK Yes fans? Because this is not the first time something like this has happened. It always seems like when there's some kind of change or something, you know, the North American fans seem to be a little bit more like, okay, well, let's see how it kind of goes. And the UK ones are always kind of like, I don't like it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something I've experienced myself, although I certainly wasn't expecting it. And I think it was on the 35th anniversary tour at the NEC or one of those Birmingham venues anyway. And the split second after a song finished, someone shouted, "Where's Rick Wakeman?" And
nice.
And it can't have been the 35th anniversary then, can it? Because Rick Wakeman was there.
No.
So it must have been the ladder tour or something. But anyway, yes, I have experienced it myself. And they do seem to be, British fans do seem to be quite a lot more reactionary. Now, maybe it's something to do with the character. What do you think? What do you think, Jeff?
Well, there probably is part of that, and I think there's probably that element of, you know, we can shout those things at people who are our own, you know. But maybe there's an explanation for it. Again, I'll throw another theory out there. I am guessing. In fact, I just quickly did a bit of Wikipedia there. So, Video Killed the Radio Star.
Mm.
Its highest chart position in the US was number 40.
Yeah.
Its highest position in the UK was number 1.
Yeah.
And from memory, for quite a while.
Yeah.
You know, every TV music show had the guy with the big glasses and the silvery jackets on TV. So the Buggles were extremely well known in the UK as a thing, which was a pop band.
Yeah.
If they weren't so well known in the US, then they were probably being assessed pretty much on face value. And maybe the first that a lot of the US audience had ever heard of the band was the Drama album.
Mm.
For most people in the UK, you would have been doing well to not know who Buggles were and not know about that song. Is that the thing that actually prompted the more negative reaction, because the fans felt we're being sold a pop band here, where maybe America had the chance to be slightly more objective?
But then what about Benoit and John Davison? You know, I mean, they were on nobody's radar.
Yeah.
But yet, when they appeared, again, it was the, well, I don't approve. Ugh.
Yeah. Yeah.
But do you think they met? I mean, I'm not sure they met, you know. I think they appeared in a different world where we have, you know, where people have the internet, where everyone on the planet has a voice. You know, I think, and again, think about, you know, this US tour, this was, you know, I think they did something like 4 or 5 nights at Madison Square Gardens.
Yeah.
You know, that is no small venue. The UK tour was actually pretty extensive, but was much smaller venues. And perhaps somebody shouting out Wakeman, as I have a friend who attended one of the shows, and he certainly experienced that, a quiet moment in Jeff Downes' keyboard solo, and one person shouted it out. It was probably much more audible than if it was someone in the back row at Madison Square Garden shouting it out. so I don't know, maybe it's those sort of factors. I think probably the other thing is that, you know, Trevor Horn talks about the challenge that the material was vocally. And anybody who sings knows the longer you're struggling, the worse your voice will get. So maybe, you know, maybe actually they were, you know, vocally, it was slightly worse than it had been in the US.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because another aspect of the character of audiences around the world is sort of counterintuitive to this, isn't it? Because us terribly reserved British-type people tend to sit, certainly now, I don't know what it was like back in the 80s and 70s and so on, when Yes concerts, maybe it was completely different, but we certainly sit now and listen to Yes. And the band itself gets, certainly Steve Howe has talked about it, getting a bit frustrated with playing in certain areas of Britain, because everybody is so reserved and like a bit more coming back, which is what you get in North America, and totally the opposite of somewhere like Japan. Maybe that's again changed a lot, but I think Japan tend to be very quiet as well and listen to the music and so on. So yeah, it's a bit counterintuitive in the end, isn't it? What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, I agree. The one thing that I find kind of interesting is that while he does seem to maybe want a little bit more reaction, there's one time that he certainly does not want reaction yes. is during his guitar pieces, because I've seen a few video pieces there where he's playing something and he's like, all right, enough of that. And he'd like stand up and berate some guy in the audience that's like making noise while he's playing. So, I mean, I think it's one of those situations that, you know, change from the circumstance. If it's like a band, you know, played piece, then yeah, maybe he wants that feedback, but certainly not when he's there alone with his acoustic.
Okay. Right. Well, I'm going to come up with my second one, because we're already half an hour into our chat, which is fantastic. So if you think about the music, and we've talked about perhaps Machine Messiah and someone coming from some jamming or you know, working together. But if you think about it, there certainly is a bit of a harder edge to it. And so it's maybe heavier, but actually, is it all just completely superficial? Is it prog goes pop on Drama? You know, there are remarkable, memorable tunes in there. It's a huge amount of fun, but is it all just superficial rubbish? What do you think, Jeff?
All just superficial rubbish. Definitely not. No, I think it has a much harder guitar edge than probably was present in Tornado and Going for the One. I think Steve's guitar playing goes in a different direction. I think that the keyboard occupies a different space as well. There are keyboard sort of solos and keyboard trading together, but you know, Jeff Downs' style is more kind of atmospheric and more smoothly melodic than maybe some of the sort of classical stylings that Rick, you know, would have put in. I definitely don't think it's superficial. I don't think it's Yes goes punk. The end result does take the Yes sound in a different direction.
Mark, is it just superficially heavier and that's about it?
I think it works perfectly, actually, to be quite honest. I mean, at the time period, they were very annoyed, very frustrated with the things that were happening, so it kind of came out in their music. They had a little bit more edge to it, you know, and they were doing some things that, you know, they didn't do as many times before on some of their other records. Like, you know, you listen to, like, Machine Messiah, they're doing a lot more unison stuff. Dun, 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 yeah, dun, yeah, dun, dun, where they're playing it together instead of having a counter melody or some harmony or something. Which makes it that much more heavier when you'd start doubling up stuff like that. I think it's exactly what it needed, to be quite honest, at that time, because progressive music, really, if you think about it, this is one of the things that I think people sometimes forget, is progress means to change, to move forward, right? I mean, you don't want to have if Yes turned into AC/DC and just released Close to the Edge every single record for the next 10 years, you would eventually get sick of it, you know what I mean? And you would want to have some change in it. And I think that kind of change was good. I mean, Jeff Downs brought in a bunch of different keyboards, different sounds are brought in. I think that it's something that was kind of sorely needed, because by that point, we were getting so used to Rick Wakeman and his, you know, batch of Moog sounds that he always used, or the type of piano playing that he was always doing. So to bring in somebody that had something completely different to offer on keyboards, for example, was sort of a breath of fresh air, I think.
Well, I think for me, I mean, obviously I was being devil's advocate with that, but I think for me it works extremely well and surprisingly well, because you do have those fabulous vocal melodies particularly, and the effects. And yes, I agree with you, Mark. Some of the effects and the sounds and the different soundscapes that Jeff Downes brought in here are really remarkable. And, you know, we're not talking about other albums, but on Fly From Here, I think that has a soundscape of its own again. And I think quite a bit of that is down to what Jeff Downes does. It's just a shame for me that it didn't extend to Heaven and Earth in quite the same way. But anyway, back to drama. Jeff, do you want to take us in another one?
Yep. Okay. So my statement is, in consideration of the Yes canon, drama was quite largely disregarded, but experienced a renaissance when John left the band in 2004. Mm-hmm. Discuss.
I absolutely, absolutely agree. Because I think for the longest time, this album was off every Yes fan's radar. It was off mine for a long time. I remember going to the record store long before I had bought this record and just looking at it and just, you know, going, meh, I don't recognize any of these songs in the back. You know, then I saw the Yes Years documentary and I saw, you know, who's this guy with these big glasses? That's not John Anderson. And so it immediately turned me off of those songs back when I was younger. And then, you know, something magical happened. John left. And then they were going to have that tour where they had, you know, the three other Yes members came out with their own different kinds of bands. And then at the end, they were going to reunite at the end of the show and do a bunch of drama songs together, right? And I think that kind of sparked it. And then when Benoit came in and they started doing the tours and we started seeing all these new songs appearing in the set list, what's this Machine Messiah? What's this Tempest Fugit? You know, I think people started realizing when they heard these songs live, how good these songs were. Because for me, I know I can only speak for me, but a lot of the times songs that I don't like on studio records, they get a second life when I hear them live and I can realize how good they are and I give them another chance and I end up loving the records. And that's exactly what happened with me with Drama. I love that record so much now. Like I said, it's in my top five easily.
Yeah. Well, it was a bit different for me, and that's because of the lack of, as we've been talking about, the lack of internet, the lack of being connected to any other Yes fans. I mean, I lived in Stratford here in a small town, and I met one other person who had even really heard of the band, and certainly the anything other than 90125 and Owner of a Lonely Heart. And he was a friend of mine who was on a music course with me, and he was a bassist. And he played the bass line of Tempest Fugit, I think, one day when we were practicing something else. And I said, oh, I recognise that. And and that was the first Yes fan I'd found. But for Drama, for me, I mean, I found it when it was, and thinking back, this is a really bizarre thing to say, I think it must have been about 6 or 7 years old, that's all, when I found it in a record shop. And at that time, I had no idea even of the chronology of the records that I had from Yes. I had to, you know, look in the fine print on the back of them to try and work out which one came where in the canon. And I didn't know anything about the Animosity, about the singer, about any changes, anything like that at all. I just took it on completely on face value that this was another Yes album. And so I stuck it on, and certainly it sounded different, but I don't remember being startled or even really noticing that much that the singer was different. And looking back now, that seems inconceivable, but I really was going from nothing. And I remember opening it up and seeing that the bizarre picture in the in the gatefold, everybody was Alan White without the shirt and all sorts of things going on there, and they're all holding their arms up in the air, and I was looking through them and I was trying to think, who's that? And Steve Howe's got this bizarre hat on, hasn't he? And long hair and so on. And I was thinking, I don't recognise, you know, three out of these five people, I don't recognise who they are at all. So it was, you know, I was really puzzled, really bamboozled by the whole Yes story, which we all are, of course, all the time. But I certainly couldn't fit this in to any kind of Yes context for me. So I just accepted it as it was and enjoyed it and have always done so. So, you know, perhaps fortunately for me, I haven't gone through that classic Yes process of losing albums and then recovering them again, which is nice. What about you, Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, my sort of first main exposure was borrowing some Yes albums from the public library back when you could do that. Yeah, my first batch included the Yes album, and it included Drama. And you know, I remember being puzzled by the kind of course this band. You know, I listened to bands like Queen and stuff like that, whose members never changed, and suddenly this was three albums that had mostly completely different people. And
yeah,
I think 9125 is the third one, and the guy who's the keyboard player in the first one was the guy who's the keyboard player in the third one, but not in the second one. And then the singer becomes the producer, and going, my goodness, there's a family tree here that's absolutely crazy. And like you, I listened to it without kind of knowledge of history or the preconceptions, and I enjoyed it and always enjoyed it. But I mean, I definitely see whenever those, you know, as Mark said, whenever those songs began to come back into the set in the Benoit era, and then ultimately moving towards covering the album in full, I think that definitely has done a lot for its reputation. We, you guys know that I contribute to a site called The Prog Report as well, and we've been doing a Progist, 31 Days of Prog in the month of August, and actually on the 40th anniversary we had Drama. We didn't actually realize we had a different Yes album chosen for that day, and then realized it's the 40th anniversary of Drama. But actually, when you look at the comments that people put, I mean, it's incredible how many people have said, this is my favorite Yes album, this is my second favorite Yes album, which I would never have considered. You know, I would have considered it, you know, for most Yes fans to be a good one, and but I wouldn't have thought most people, you know, would have it in their top three, but a lot of people seem to, and I think that must in some part be due to the current lineup actually, you know, helping return it to, you know, to its place in the catalog.
Yes, I'm sure that's true, and I for one am very very glad that I managed to hear it live in its entirety. All right, I think we've got just time for one more. So, Mark, do you want to give us a final thing to think about?
Yes, and this is a relatively simple. wondering how you guys think again. This is something that kind of ran through my mind quite a bit when we were talking about doing this sort of roundtable discussion about Drama. So, do you think fans would have returned 1981 if they decided to stick with Trevor and said, you know what, we're going forward with this lineup, we're sticking with our guns, we're going through with this and we're moving forward, do you think that the fans would have just kind of said, okay, you know what, I'm going to give it another shot and come back? And what do you think would have happened?
You can go first, Jeff, because I think this is difficult.
Well, part of the answer must be, well, it depends what they came back with. But I suppose knowing, back, my earlier comment was about being a 36-minute album. We know that when they went on tour, they integrated into the set Fly From Here, which was the song that sort of got them through the door to begin with, and that they also, Steve Howe had Go Through This, which was also played live. Let's assume they were starting Drama 2 with those two pieces of music in the bag. You know, those are two pretty solid, pretty good songs, which continue in that vein. We also know some of the stuff that was contemporary to that material that ended up on Fly From Here when it came out. And I think, you know, if an album came out like that, I think it would have been very good. I think Yes fans would have accepted it very well. I don't, however, think that it would have done a 90125. I think it probably would have prolonged Yes's life for maybe another album and tour cycle. You know, would it have carved a way forward for the band in the climate that was developing?
Well, I think you're right. I think it did depend on that. And I'm just wondering how different Fly From Here itself would have been. Would they have had even the notion of developing it into some kind of suite as it exists now on the two different versions that we've got? Probably not. Yeah, I think they could have done. I think though that I get the feeling that it might have all fallen apart if they'd gone back into the studio after that, after the end of the drama tour. So I'm not sure it could ever really have happened with those characters and the state they were in. Trevor Horn, you know, that must be one of the most, if not the most, difficult thing to do as a vocalist, to step in and sing those songs. And there's that famous anecdote, isn't there, about him having this recurring nightmare of finding himself on the stage at Madison Square Garden. And then he was with Yes on the stage at Madison Square Garden, trying to sing all these John Anderson lines at the proper pitch, of course, which John Anderson himself didn't do later on himself. I can't see that it would have happened, unfortunately, although I would have loved it to. What about you yourself, Mark?
Well, I think what's interesting about it is, I think the one thing that people are maybe forgetting is that those guys are pretty prolific writers, you know, Jeff Downes and Trevor Horn.
Yeah.
I think that material would not have been an issue with them. I think they would have been like the John Anderson of old, whereas he came up with ideas and stuff like that, and they weaved it into Yes Music, the rest of the guys. So I think that the material wouldn't have been an issue. What I think would have been maybe is that, you know, whether the fans would have accepted this direction that they would have went through forward. But, you know, another thing you have to keep in mind, too, is that they were relatively new to the whole thing, and everything went really quickly from the time they got into the band to when the record got out and they were out on tour. Mm. By that time, they could have been more settled. He could have been a bit more comfortable with it. And, you know, obviously he wasn't, as we know through history. But maybe if he would have, you know, took a different approach to it, maybe if they would have let him sing a little bit more in his comfort zone, maybe he would have got more comfortable with it. Maybe the whole situation would have became a bit more comfortable and they would have moved forward. And then, you know how people are. They start seeing that the tours are going again, coming back. People are going out to see it. And then, you know, all of a sudden, oh, maybe I'll give it another try. And then maybe it might have went forward.
Yeah.
You're right. I mean, there's a very big point there, Mark, underneath all of this. You know, this was over within 9 months of it starting.
Yeah.
You know, our timeline here is in March 1980, Anderson and Wakeman were still in the band, albeit very unhappy. Mm. Horn and Downes were in recording between April and June. The album came out in August. You know, so that is from April to not being in the band to having an album on the racks. Touring started straight away, and again, part of the story is here there was an American tour that was booked.
Yeah.
The publicity guys were pretty mute on the fact that, you know, there was a lineup change, and again, we're pre-internet, so, you know, people will have gone maybe with an expectation of something, and again, equally surprising that it went down well in America. But that touring ended in December, and it was done. You know, the band had 9 months of presumably a pretty tight deadline to make an album, a tight to get out onto the road, you know, to tour, you know, at a pretty high level, and then to collapse. You know, it didn't have much of a chance to get on its feet. Which, and I mean, you guys know I'm a big fan of the album, and a big fan of Fly From Here and of Trevor Horn. And part of me does go, it's a bit of a shame that it didn't get the chance to breathe a little bit more. And who knows, you know, there's other things Trevor has sung on, and, you know, he has a vocal style. You know, some of the things we talked about earlier on, if you listen to a Buggles record, you know, Trevor's vocals are great.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, with a concentrated period where actually they were writing stuff that actually suited his styling.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, it could have been something good, and add into his commerciality that edge that he brought to it. You know, who knows? They could have come up with something that was, you know, that took things to the next level.
Okay. Well, I think we're coming to the end of the time we've got, so let's all come up with, I'll give you a second to think about this, just a single statement about how important you think drama is as a Yes fan to you. So, who wants to go first? Mark?
Yeah, well, I think drama to me is a pretty important record to me. I really enjoy the music. To me, because I got to it so late, you know, even though it was such an old record, it was like, you know, a new discovery. It was like discovering gold in your backyard or something. It was like, wow, this is such a great record. And I think it also was important to me in another way, that it kind of gave me this knowledge of that you can change something that's so constant and have hope that it can move forward. You know what I mean? Like, I think that bands sometimes fear change, but sometimes when it happens, good things come out of it.
Mm, great. I couldn't agree more. Jeff?
It's just as well we're all not in the same room when I say this, but I'll say it anyway, and you'll maybe never invite me back. I think drama helped correct a downward trajectory in as far as the Yes canon is concerned, and it set it on the path to 90125, which ultimately, whether we love it or we hate it, I think is one of the reasons why actually we still have Yes, or indeed multiple Yeses in existence today. I'm not sure that if there was no drama and there was no 90125, I'm not sure we might even be here talking about it today.
No. I think that's a great point. Of course, you're meaning a downward trend after Tomato, and you're just referring to the disastrous Paris.
No, I'm not.
No. I'm sure you are. Anyway, so yes, just to finish off then, my own thoughts. I think it's actually an extremely effective album, and what I mean by that is I can put it on and listen to it from one song to the next as a complete album and really enjoy its the way it fits together, the way it segues from one song to another. I think it holds together extremely well, and I think it still does. I think, you know, anyone picking it up today who has even a vague interest in pop music, in rock music, in progressive rock music, any kind of music, can find a lot to enjoy in there. And I think that's because, going back to my idea about prog goes pop, because I think the blend of progressive elements, if you think about something like Machine Messiah, which is a long song, but it's got fantastic hooks that I think come from a pop background, but also fantastic progressive elements in there as well. So I just think it's a fantastically enjoyable album, and I'm so glad that it exists. Okay, thank you very much indeed. Talking about drama on its 40th birthday, or close to its 40th birthday anyway. So thank you very much indeed, Jeff.
Thank you. Great to talk to you guys. I'm happy to come back anytime.
And thank you to Mark.
You're welcome, guys. It was good to have you on, Jeff.